when you think about Hamas's grievances, they've been thwarted twice, right? They were thwarted once by Arafat in the late 80s, early 90s. So he says, hey, look at me over here. I'm in Tunisia and I'm going to recognize Israel right now. And I'm going to start a peace process. He did this to outflank Hamas. And Hamas was pissed. So that's the first time that Hamas gets sidelined. Then they have the election in 2006 and they get sidelined again. They win the election, but nobody lets them take over. So when you see their deep-seated hatred and anti-Semitic, anti-Israel rhetoric, and you think about their history of being frustrated, this sort of gives you a picture of why we saw just absolutely unadulterated, brutal violence.
Welcome to the Danger Close podcast, presented by 6hour.
My guest today is Jonathan Shanzer. Jonathan is the Senior Vice President of Research for the Defense of Democracy. Prior to that, he was a terrorism finance analyst at the U.S. Department of Treasury. He's the author of multiple books, including State of Failure, Yasser Arafat, Mahmoud Abbas, and the Unmaking of the Palestinian State, Hamas versus Fatah, the Struggle for Palestine, and Gaza Conflict 2021, Hamas, Israel, and 11 Days of War. And now, without further ado, Jonathan Shanzer. So excited that you agreed to come on and talk, because a conversation like this that goes deeper, where there is nuance, where there is understanding, you have to have a foundation. If your foundation is 1 minute and 30 seconds of somebody that you see talking on television as you walk by, who just got grabbed and thrown in there because they needed to fill a slot, that shouldn't be the basis of your understanding of this conflict or any conflict.
You know, when you watch the coverage of this, it's so utterly simplified in the American press, where it's just sort of like, oh, Israel occupies, Gaza or occupies the West Bank. And therefore, that's why, you know, they're fighting. The incredible complexities here of this ongoing conflict. And it is as much of a political contest between the Palestinian factions as it is a military contest between Israel and any one of these actors. And no one seems to take the time to parse this stuff and to unpack it.
Now, was Hamas a splinter group of the Muslim Brotherhood at its inception? And what was, from the get-go, was it always in opposition to Yasser Arafat?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's, first of all, it was a splinter faction of the Brotherhood, which up until 1987, up until the Intifada, had been peaceful. Anti-Israel, but peaceful. And again, I think that is, at least in some ways, what explains the relative calm that we saw until the Intifada. And then you have the Brotherhood, or elements of the Brotherhood, say, you know what, this whole peaceful coexistence thing, nah, we're not doing that anymore.
Owning a rifle is an awesome responsibility. Building rifles is no different. Started in a garage by a Marine veteran more than two decades ago, BCM, Bravo Company MFG, designs, engineers, and manufactures life-saving tools built to a professional standard. BCM builds professional-grade AR rifles and offers a huge and expanding line of upgraded accessories for the rifle, including buttstocks, pistol grips, optic mounts, handguards, vertical grips, and a lot more. BCM is partnered with veteran American Special Operations Forces instructors to ensure our customers have access to proven training to employ critical hard skills under stress. Every BCM product is a collaboration between our design, engineering team, and combat veteran end users. BCM components improve handling and reliability in all scenarios, addressing shortcomings discovered in real-world conditions with legacy systems. We assume that when a rifle leaves our shop, it could be used in a life-or-death situation. Each component is hand-assembled and tested by Americans in Heartland, Wisconsin. Bravo Company MFG is an employee-owned company. Visit us on the web at bravocompanymfg.com and on Instagram at bravocompanyusa.
Palestinians and the Arab world have consistently rejected a two-state solution with Israel, and then they push themselves into war. They lose those wars, and then they lose leverage and they lose territory time and again. So Gaza could have been part of an officially recognized Palestinian state in 48. It wasn't. Israel goes on to win the war of 1948. And what you have is the West Bank and the Gaza Strip under the occupation, literally, of other countries in the region. So the Jordanians occupy the West Bank and Egypt occupies the Gaza Strip. That goes on until 1967. There's another war, again, with all the Arab states looking to destroy Israel. Israel conquers then the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. And it's at that moment that everybody starts to talk about them as occupied territories because the Israelis now control them and it's against the will of the people. They were occupied before. No one called it that. But what happens after that is kind of an uneasy 20 years of Palestinian nationalism kind of growing organically in these two places. And then in 87, we see what's known as the Intifada, Palestinian uprising. It is a spontaneous attempt to try to undermine the Israeli presence in Gaza. And it actually leads to a peace process between the Palestinians and Israelis throughout the 1990s. The problem is that at that same time, we see the rise of an organization called Hamas. Hamas begins to carry out terrorist attacks against Israel throughout the 1990s. They have two goals. One is to kill as many Israelis and as many Jews as possible. And that's been consistent with Hamas's worldview from the get-go. But the other is to try to derail this peace process that was underway that could have actually led to a renewed two-state solution. Hamas carries out suicide bombings for the better part of a decade. And then the peace process ultimately collapses in the year 2000. Hamas, you could argue, prevailed in weakening the ties between the pragmatists within Palestinian society and Israel. And what happens after that, the year 2000, we see the outbreak of the Second Intifada, as it's known. This is a brutal campaign of suicide bombings and horrific attacks throughout Israel. Israel responds by targeting Hamas and any other terrorist group that attacks it. That all ends by 2005. But the problem is that by then, it's total chaos within the Palestinian territories. And then really one of the most idiotic chapters in American foreign policy is written. And that is when George W. Bush and Condoleezza Rice say, hey, you know what? They are completely chaotic in the West Bank and Gaza right now. But hey, let's hold an election and let's let Hamas take part in this election. The same group that's been bombing Israelis, carrying out suicide bombings and trying to disrupt the peace process. Let's give them a stake in the Palestinian political arena. And everybody said, yeah, it's fine. Don't worry about it. The Palestinian Authority will remain in the hands of the pragmatists. Well, as it turns out, in 2006, the election results come in and Hamas wins. And they want to take over the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And the Israelis say no. The Americans say no. And this leads to a standoff that is finally shattered in the year 2007. It's the most fateful year in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, in my view. Hamas takes over the Gaza Strip by force. It's a brutal war. They kill their own people. They push them off of tall buildings to their deaths. They shoot them in the legs and arms to ensure permanent disability. It's a civil war. And ever since then, we have seen, this is now 16 years running, Hamas has had its own territory. It's had its own little statelet. It's not recognized by anybody, but it is a little mini Taliban like state controlled by a terrorist organization. And since that time, they've carried out rocket wars against Israel, 2008, 2012, 2014, 2021, and now this current conflict. Israel each time has been able to absorb the rocket fire through better technology and better defenses. Iron Dome, you may have heard of, this incredible missile defense system. It's 90-95% accurate. So, you know, you see Hamas firing off 3,000 rockets, the vast majority are not going to land in Israel, and it's saved countless lives on both sides. But what I think we've seen now since 10/7, this is bringing us full circle, since the October 7th massacre, and just to be clear, it was, you know, you can see the pictures, you can see the video, it was a pogrom It was 1,400 people just murdered in cold blood, 240 people taken hostage. The Israelis have made the decision that the status quo cannot continue, that Hamas cannot remain in control of the Gaza Strip any longer. And that's what this war is all about. It is, from Israel's perspective, it is an effort to completely destroy Hamas in the Gaza Strip. It's not unlike what we saw with ISIS, with our own challenges there. We made a decision. That's it. If this organization can no longer exist. Now, of course, there's still remnants that we can see throughout the Middle East, but we destroyed the caliphate, as it were, and that has left ISIS homeless. This is, I think, going to be the goal for the Israelis. And, you know, obviously, there are a lot of people who would like to see a two-state solution, ultimately see a Palestinian state. And, you know, I don't want to throw cold water on that, because I do think that, you know, in a perfect world, that is what we would try to aim for. The problem has been, like I said, it's been disastrous Palestinian leadership throughout. Really terrible decisions that have been made that have pushed the these two people to conflict rather than to coexistence.
What happened in 1987 that led to the first intifada? What was the trigger that led to that and the creation of Hamas?
A lot of Gazans were going to work in Israel. Actually, what happened was there was a flatbed truck of laborers that were coming back after a long day of working in Israel. And there was a car accident. An Israeli military vehicle rear-ended that truck, leading to the deaths of some of those that were in it. And what happened was those people, it's customary in Islamic tradition to bury the dead immediately. So within hours, there were funeral processions, and those funeral processions turned into chants of protest. And those chants of protests then led to larger rallies, and the rallies spread from Gaza City, from the northern Gaza Strip, throughout all of the Gaza Strip, and then spread to the West Bank. And the next thing you know, there is an asymmetric low-level battle going on, primarily with Palestinians throwing rocks and Molotov cocktails and things like that. But then quickly we begin to see the rise of Hamas. And, you know, you have to remember also at the time, the PLO, which had been the sort of the primary actor in Palestinian politics, they were not in the West Bank and they were not in the Gaza Strip. They were in exile in Tunisia. For those that know their history, there was a civil war where the Lebanese were essentially hijacked, right, by the PLO. They had become a state within a state, and they were attacking Israel. And Israel went in, not unlike what we're seeing right now. They said, this terrorist organization has to go. We are going to kick it out of the country. And it was disastrous for the Lebanese people to have this happen. But ultimately, we actually watched the PLO surrender and get on boats that took them to Tunisia. We could be seeing a very similar situation play out if things go the way I think the U.S. and Israel would like it to see the forced exile of Hamas. In other words, they're fighting right now with the intent to fight to the death. There could come a moment where, you know, they begin to look around and realize the rubble of Gaza is all on their heads, and that maybe it's time for them to just simply pack up and leave. That would be the better of the options that I see in front of everybody right now. But really, I think it's going to depend on the Gaza-based Hamas leadership, and maybe, just maybe, some of their foreign patrons that could have influence over Hamas. And there I'm talking about Iran, which, of course, I don't expect the Iranians to call for a ceasefire. They, you know, they will fight Israel to the last Palestinian. That has always been their strategy. They don't need to get their hands dirty. They get other people to fight their wars. And it's amazing to me that that is still not understood widely in the United States or around the world. But it's not just Iran that I think that could have the influence here. I mean, there are other countries that are nominal allies of the United States. I think, by the way, I think it's embarrassing that they are. But, you know, consider the fact that Turkey, a NATO ally, is a patron of Hamas. There's a headquarters there, and the Turks could say, guys, pack up, get out, save the 2.2 million people of Gaza. Do it now. That would be one option. The other is the Qataris. Qataris are a major non-NATO ally. That is an official label that we have given the Qataris. We've got our largest airbase in the Middle East over there. We're fighting the war on terror. And right down the street from that Al Udeid airbase is a Hamas headquarters, right? These are countries that you could imagine could have a significant influence on the calculus of Hamas as this war drags on. When you think about Hamas's grievances, they've been thwarted twice, right? They were thwarted once by Arafat in the late 80s, early 90s. So he says, hey, look at me over here. I'm in Tunisia and I'm going to recognize Israel right now. And I'm going to start a peace process. He did this to outflank Hamas. And Hamas was pissed. So that's the first time that Hamas gets sidelined. Then they have the election in 2006 and they get sidelined again. They win the election, but nobody lets them take over. So when you see their deep-seated hatred and anti-Semitic, anti-Israel rhetoric, and you think about their history of being frustrated, this sort of gives you a picture of why we saw just absolutely unadulterated, brutal violence carried out by Hamas. Nothing justifies it, but you might begin to at least understand their mindset. They're already deeply violent jihadi organizations. It's a jihadist organization that, you know, gets, you know, it has an ideological affinity with groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda. Same sort of intellectual basis for the building up of the ideology of this group. They get funding and training and weapons from Iran, and they hate Israel, and they've been thwarted multiple times as they've tried to assert their leadership. It is palpable anger